This episode was made possible by a grant from the Virginia Museum of History and Culture's Commonwealth History Fund presented by Dominion Energy, and by a grant from Virginia Humanities.
Just a note before we begin. In this episode, most of the Algonquin words used are based on English pronunciations. Tribes in Virginia are beginning to awaken their regional Powhatan Algonquin language and pronunciation. On any given day, visitors eager to experience America's first permanent English colony roam the Jamestown Settlement Museum. As they take in the 1607 Jamestown, I wonder, will they consider the land below their feet where my ancestors once hunted? Our voices, our stories, they weren't always included here. Today, with our help, the museum is telling the history of the tribes in Virginia in our words. Among its exhibits, there's a single object enclosed in its own glass case. It's been called the Royal Robe of the Virginian King Powhatan and other labels, a cape, a habit, a cloak, a wall hanging, and a map. Today, we refer to it as Powhatan's mantle, and it's grand. Nearly 8 feet tall and 5 feet wide, the mantle evokes the history and culture of the powerful alliance of tribes. The people colonists encountered when they first arrived more than 400 years ago. And it's not just its size, it's the mastery of construction. 4 white-tailed deerskins carefully trimmed and sewn together and adorned with seaboard marginella shells, most likely found along the York and James Rivers. Their natural gloss made them look polished. There are some 20,000 of those shells. Each pointed end had to be rubbed down by hand so the sinew thread could pass through and intricately sewn onto the skins. At the center of the deerskins is a human figure made of shell embroidery. From a distance, they appear as beads. For this, each shell had to be rounded. On either side of the human figure are 2 different animals in profile facing the human. These 2 are also made of shell embroidery. Then, as though flowing like rivers up and down around the human and animal figures, are 34 spiral shell clusters. Each shell represents a town in the alliance. Visitors often linger and sit on a nearby bench.
I just love the artistry of it because the needles that they used were so tiny and fine that the sinew that they were sewing the shells on to represent the different towns didn't pierce the backside of the deer skin. And I just think that that's incredible and a testament to the artistry of people then.
That's Elena, a visitor who used to work at the museum. What most visitors don't know is the history of the mantle, but not this one. This one is a replica made painstakingly by members of the Mattapani tribe. It has its own story. I'm talking about the real one, the one made more than 400 years ago by my ancestors and ancestors of other tribes. Those people were here for tens of thousands of years before colonists arrived. They were part of that powerful alliance, Powhatan's Alliance. The original mantle, that belonged to Wahan Sanaka, chief of the Powhatan. And it's in a museum in Oxford, England. How it got there? Well, that's going to take this episode to tell you. There are twists and turns all immersed in mystery. The kind of mystery that comes with looking back 420 years to times of treachery, diplomacy, and acquiring other people's things. And for the first time, you're going to hear the story of Powhatan's mantle told by citizens from the tribes once joined under Powhatan's alliance. I'm Rebecca Hill, a citizen of the Pamunkey Indian tribe, the same tribal affiliation of Wahan Sanaka, chief of the Powhatan alliance. This is Tribal Truths.
Going to England, see an old friend of mine. It's about
time.
Bumping around in a golf cart through the woods are 3 citizens from tribes once allied under the Powhatan chiefdom. They're navigating the place where Wahan Sanaka ruled more than 400 years ago. and it may be where the mantle was made. Driving the golf cart is Kalen Anderson. He's a citizen of the Nansemond Indian Nation. Kalen works for the National Park Service, which stewards these 264 acres in Gloucester, Virginia. When they emerge into a field, they can see the York River.
I'm pretty certain it's some place.
Yeah, we're coming up on the, this is basically downtown Wiracomico. So if you look at this chart, a lot of the archaeology done, this shows the populace of artifacts, I think primarily ceramic and pottery. This is all waterfront, and you see the dissipation of artifacts as you work your way back. So this was basically the hub, everyday life, families. You can imagine young men and, and boys coming off their dugout canoes, coming up, maybe, women and children cooking, making succotash up here in their pots. And today we love waterfront property. All of our tribes were water people, river people, living right on the water. So we don't really change that much over time.
Wiracomico is one of the most important and sacred places to the Algonquian tribes that once belonged to the Powhatan Alliance. People were here more than 9,000 years ago, before Wahansanaka took his place of political and spiritual power as supreme leader, or as we say, Mamanitowic. He inherited his power from his mother, and with that power he forged political alliances through marriage and the children he had with those wives. He established extensive trade networks and tribute systems, bringing 34 smaller chiefdoms under his leadership. And if you remember, the mantle has 34 shell spirals, one for every town. So back in 2002, scientists confirmed what we already knew. Wiracomico's location on a 300-acre former plantation along the York River. We knew because we've been here all along.
Yeah, you can take clam rakes and rake them and put them in 5-gallon buckets.
Only to us, the river was the Pamunkey. And just below Wiracomico was Almondsville.
The last name Almond shows up in our communities. And right across the creek here is Almond's Wharf, and that's where they were said to have come from.
Sam McGowan is a citizen of the Mattapani tribe. He works for the Jamestown-Yorktown Foundation, where he uses his expertise in making indigenous tools, beading and recreating other examples of his culture to teach. Like many indigenous people here, he recalls his childhood fishing off the shore here on the York River.
Well, it's all shallow going out here. We used to come up here where the shelf drops out there. That's where we used to do a lot of flounder fishing. And then Red Bank is further down going towards Pamunkey Neck, towards our way, towards West Point, which West Point was a large trading hub at one point for our people, Sinquotec. And that's where Opecancanoe's, one of his homes, were right situated above it.
Opecancanoe was Wahansanaka's brother and another powerful leader. Now, his former home and trading hub is the site of the West Rock Paper Mill in West Point, Virginia. Like Sam, most indigenous people today who fish off these shores have been told by ancestors, this is Wiracomico. And Wiracomico may be where Powhatan's mantle was created. The shell of the sea snail used for the mantle can be found today in tributaries like the York and along the shores around the Chesapeake Bay. The golf cart emerges from the woods to the edge of the field. Ahead is the York River and the current home of the former owners of Wiracomico. It's been a national park property since 2016. Just to the left are bright orange traffic cones marking where the chief's sacred longhouse may have once stood. If you've ever seen Captain John Smith's 1612 map of Virginia, the house is depicted in ceremony with Wahansanaka in the upper left corner. Smith also describes the house and location, which helped archaeologists determine this may be where it once stood.
I actually dug here at the longhouse spot, where we started uncovering the post holes again that would help us define that this was a structure and how large it was. So yes, this was definitely an entire block of archaeological excavations that took place.
That's Ashley Spivey. She's a citizen of the Pamunkey Indian tribe and my cousin. She's executive director of an anthropological consulting firm. She's worked as a part of the archaeology team that discovered the location of the chief's house. She's continued that work with the National Park Service and Virginia Tribes.
And I have about 20 years of experience working out here at Oro Wacomico. And it was one of the last, I think, field seasons that was funded and that we were, we didn't know if we were gonna have another one. So I think it's also kind of serendipitous that it was uncovered in one of those last field seasons.
As with the post that supported the chief's house, most of what was once here has gone back to nature. But hints of daily life centuries ago remain in pieces of pottery, stone tools, bone, shell, and trash pits. There are also signs of trade with colonists from nearby Jamestown, like pieces of copper. Some of the finds are 10,000 years old, but farms are hard on artifacts.
And unfortunately, when they would come through and deep plow, that really disturbed a lot of the artifacts that were in the ground and misplaced them because, I mean, it was just pulling up earth and dragging it and mixing things together. So it makes it a little more difficult.
But there's one artifact that's mostly intact. It's pretty incredible. After 4 centuries, Powhatan's mantle is only missing some of its shells, likely taken by tourists or scientists or lost in the years of being moved. Until recently, no one at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, England, has invited our tribes to give their interpretation of the meaning of the mantle. When Sam was younger, he said the shape looked like a turtle and related it to Turtle Island, a spiritual term used by indigenous people in North America to refer to the continent. And there's a 34 embroidered spiraled shell circles.
I think of the circle, the imagery of the circle and the meaning of the circle and the spiral. And I also think about the way that village and town sites in the region, from an archaeological standpoint, right, archaeological work that's been done at these places has uncovered a circular spatial footprint of all of these different sites across the Tidewater region that are contemporaneous with one another. What I mean by that, like between probably around 1100, 1200, up until the time that the English arrive in the 1600s, you're seeing the circular spiral spatial layout in the actual architecture and footprints of the village sites. And you see it here at Oro Wacomico on a major grand scale.
Also important here are large semicircular ditches found demarcating the town from the sacred site of the chief's house, where religious ceremony likely took place. The longhouse was huge at 70 feet long by 30 feet wide, which you can see prominently marked on Captain John Smith's map. And those large semicircular, double D-like shapes are marked clearly on the navigational chart provided to the King of Spain by Don Pedro de Zuniga.
I see the imagery in the mantle, I see it in the archaeological footprint that our ancestors left, and in other items like pottery and, you know, decorative treatments that I've seen in material culture. So I just wanted to like riff on that a little bit because the circle is really important.
Yeah, those circles are in everything. Look at your thumb. Yeah, you see them right there. I mean, you see them in wood, you see them in shells. And that's why a lot of these items were so important, these specific materials, because of that. They were often used more towards the spiritual aspect of our culture.
Sam is an expert in our cultures and carries on traditions of how our ancestors made things.
Maybe he could have gotten his wives to sew one because, you know, he had well over 24 wives. So that would make sense. So that way he'd have children in each community. So it could be that. But again, you know, it's an educated guess. It could be someone, maybe a werewance, a werewansqua, could have had someone appointed to do it. Something that maybe we can figure out one day. You know, our people believed in balance. So, you know, one person's job complemented the next.
A werewance or werewansqua are male and female leaders. Sam learned much of what he knows from his mother, Shirley Little Dove Custelo McGowan, who was a well-regarded historian and lecturer of indigenous history in Virginia. As a teenager, he and his mother saw Powhatan's mantle when it was on loan to Jamestown Settlement Museum in 1990. They helped to make the replica mantle.
What I like to do, I like to look at the construction of the hide and look at the symbolism of the man, the Manitowoc, supreme ruler, supreme chief, Wahun Seneca, Chief Powhatan. then you have the deer, and then you have the mountain lion or the cougar. And I think we really need to look at what the cougar and what the deer represents. And I just thinking of some of our creation stories about how the Creator created the earth and how he peopled the earth. He talked about the great, you know, deer that he created, but the cannibals ate it. And then, of course, he made new and spread from the hairs of the deer. So I think that deer may represent subsistence. It provided our people with food. It's very important. Food, clothing, tools. And then, of course, you think about the cougar. It represents strength, unity, protection. And then you have all the spirals and the shells. If you look not only with our communities, but as Ashley said, communities to the north, south, and even to the west, all over the world, actually, it represents life, a continuity, and personal growth. And it makes sense. You know, and you have all these spirals, 34 of them. And at the time that the English arrived here in Seneca Maca, we know that Wahoon Seneca had over 30 major tribes under his leadership and over 200 communities spreading throughout the entire coastal plain region of Virginia. So definitely it's showing its importance.
Sam said Seneca Maca, or as some say, Seneca Maca. That's the word we use in Algonquin language. It's interpreted as the Virginia Tidewater lands we occupied. That representation on the mantle, all the beauty and artisanship crafted into spiritual and political representation, likely took a long time to make. After it was completed, it probably was kept in a prominent place inside the chief's house. But how could it have ended up in a museum so far away from here? In the fall of 1608, there was a meeting of dignitaries, Wahoon Seneca, and the English captains John Smith and Christopher Newport from Jamestown. Both worked for the Virginia Company. Smith was an English explorer, soldier, and colonizer. Smith already had established a relationship with Wahoon Seneca. He had even been through a special ceremony where he was accepted. Within a year, he would be stealing their food and destroying their towns. Captain Newport was a privateer, one of the Queen's favorite pirates who stole from Spanish and Portuguese ships. He commanded the initial expedition that led to Jamestown and was on the first council in Virginia. During these first years, he was ferrying people and supplies to the new colony. On this day in 1608, he was on a mission for King James I to meet with the chief of the Powhatan, Wahoon Seneca. In Captain John Smith's book, A True Relation, the meeting took place at Oropax. That's where the mantle may have begun its long journey to the Ashmolean Museum.
The location is thought to be Powhatan's Hill, right off of the James River. It's adjacent to a part of the Fulton Hill neighborhood in Richmond, the city of Richmond. It's a park now. And actually, our folks commemorated that park 100 years ago. So my great-great-grandfather was there, and I know Mattup and I folks were there. That is where it's believed that this event took place, where the Powhatan's mantle was being presented to Newport. It was before any kind of official treaty negotiations were happening, and this was probably an event for that, for negotiation, for discussion. And at these types of meetings, even between tribes, there would have been objects presented and shared and exchanged.
They were trying to get Powhatan to step down and recognize King James as his king. They had to force Powhatan down because he would not bow to them.
They were trying to basically force a mock coronation of Powhatan to demonstrate, like, hey, you're in charge, but we really need you to bend the knee to the true sovereign, which is the king, right? And as Sam said, he was refusing to do that because bowing was not a part of our culture, and that's not how we would have revered somebody, and he was definitely not subservient.
The account by Smith says Wahoon Seneca gave Newport his mantle, but Sam believes the mantle was stolen.
Most of the other tribal citizens, not just within, you know, Mattapony, Pamunkey, within the other communities here in Seneca Maca as well, believed it was taken by force. This is something way too significant, and I don't believe he would have just gifted or given that to him. He had too much pride for that.
Smith also said Wahoon Seneca gave Newport a pair of old moccasins, If true, these didn't make it to the museum, and we don't have the knowledge of what those meant to our people. For colonists, shoes were a prestige item, so it could have been a show of wealth. But if they were taken from the chief, that would have been an insult, leaving him without shoes to protect his feet. The act would be something a pirate would do. Powhatan's mantle comes with many interpretations.
So maybe the item was an object of diplomacy for this meeting. What it actually meant, not 100% sure.
There's another indigenous scholar who has her own interpretation of Powhatan's mantle, one Ashley finds intriguing. Today is the opening day of the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in Washington, D.C. This year, it's celebrating indigenous people worldwide. It's also the 20th anniversary of the National Museum of the American Indian, which is where we meet Gabrielle Tyack. Gabrielle is a member of the Piscataway Beaver Clan, which occupies land in Maryland, but once lived here as well. She's a historian and scholar.
I have very strong ties to this place because first it is on Piscataway traditional ancestral land, and also because I was brought in 1999 to help the museum, even before it was opened, understand the place where they sit, and that is within the Chesapeake region, which includes Powhatan peoples, Monacan peoples, Piscataway, Nanticoke, all of us that have made our homes and lives along these waterways.
Gabrielle was a historian and curator at the museum for 17 years. During that time, she went to England to look at historical documents and to study the mantle.
There's been different interpretations of what does the mantle say? You know, what does it mean? Is it a map of Powhatan's territory? Is it in fact a royal robe? Is it a cosmological representation of clans? Or would it be clan symbols of Powhatan being, maybe there's Deer Clan and Panther Clan? There's been all of these theories and ideas about what these figures could represent. And I just had it tucked in the back of my mind also that we would maybe try to figure this out. Or can we ever, right? Can we ever?
At Oxford University, the mantle at the Ashmolean Museum kept drawing her back.
I was spending time looking at the mantle, meeting with the conservators and curators and other departments at the university, and just thinking through. And I started to really fixate on this idea of who are you, how can we know you?
Then, on her very last day in England, with just 4 hours before her flight home, she and a colleague made an appointment with the British Museum's Special Collections Room. They wanted to see the watercolors that were done in 1585 of the Chiefs of Virginia and Roanoke by John White of Secatan.
And most of what we see, it's often used to represent Powhatan peoples and Piscataway peoples and people throughout the Atlantic seaboard of, you know, what the towns and houses and leaders look like. And I went to look at them, and they're absolutely beautiful and also very small.
Then the librarian asked if they'd like to see Captain John Smith's original map of New England. If you remember, Smith had done the famous 1608 map of Virginia.
I was like, yeah, okay, look at it. I'm here. And I look at this map, and it's very interesting to look at. But what I notice in the corner of the map, it's the royal coat of arms. And it has the crown in the center, a lion on the left-hand side, and a unicorn with, you know, which is a hoofed animal, on the right-hand side. And it just, something clicked, and I thought about the mantle, and it has a man of power in the center and a mountain lion on the left-hand side with five toes and a long tail. and a hoofed animal, which is a deer, on the right-hand side. And I thought, wait a minute.
And she calls her colleague over.
I was like, tell me if I've lost my mind. But do you think that the mantle could be the royal coat of arms in Indigenous representation? And I was like, there's the man of power in the middle and the lion on one side and the hooves on the other. And she looked at me and she said, I don't know, maybe. And we just looked at each other and I thought, this is crazy.
But it wasn't because all her research was coming into focus.
Powhatan is this mighty man with this, not just as the person himself, but is also representing very powerful people. He's living in his own world. They're in their own space. They're at the height of their power and authority. They're exerting their determination. They're already thinking that they're making the captain their sub-chief, which makes total sense. Like, this just, that this is a representation of the power of Powhatan. It's a representation of his sovereign authority. And this is what's being said over time. The 34 spirals, and this had already come up as a mapping possibility, and it is partially a map, but this is his domain, this is his reign, this is his place, right? And if you want to use those English terms. So really looking at the mantle itself as a piece that truly represents authority. So could this have been staying within the possession of the Powhatan, to express that authority or to show it in some way? I would say whether it was sent as a symbol or an assertion of power to the crown, or if it was stolen from within Powhatan possession, the ownership of it, especially given the level of absolute ransacking, and this is all that is left.
We don't know when the mantle went to England. If it was given to Captain Christopher Newport for King James I, it may have been on his ship, the Mary and Margaret, when he left for England in December 1608. Ship manifests may not have objects like the mantle listed on them, but we would have to go to England for this research. We also don't know if the mantle was given to King James I. The first documentation of the mantle, or what is said to be the mantle, shows up in England with a man named John Tredescant. It's 30 years after the mantle was supposedly gifted to King James I. At the time it shows up, Tredescant is King Charles's gardener. Charles was the son and successor of James. What's also of note here, Tredescant is friends with Captain John Smith and Captain Sam Argall, the same Captain Argall who kidnapped Wahasanaka's daughter, Pocahontas. To find out more about the life of the mantle in England, we talked with Katrina Marchant, a British scholar of literary material and cultural history, who specializes in this time period.
So if we look at the Ashmolean Museum's website, they assert that this mantle is first recorded as being in the Tredescant collection in July of 1638. They point out that how it gets there is not known, but, quote, the most widely accepted explanation is that it may be one of the gifts, in heavy inverted commas potentially, presented by Powhatan in 1608 to Captain Newport for King James I.
The mantle may have been important to colonists because they needed funding from investors of the Virginia Company of London and the king. Before James I took the throne, Queen Elizabeth was constantly being asked for financial support for various ventures.
Somebody like Christopher Newport, or an individual who was working for one of these people who is funding a voyage to do this stuff is going to want to bring something back that wets the whistle of the king. You want that royal approval. You know, throughout Elizabeth's reign, they're constantly searching for it. They're trying to bring her back things, whether it's black rock that they are sure is full of gold, or whether it's, you know, promises or people or whatever they're doing. They want her to believe that this could be her new land. Because, I mean, particularly for Elizabeth, she is not keen on colonization or plantation. She is not in favour of that, mostly because I think it's a risk of money and war. She recognises that.
And of course, people working for the royals have a backstory that's best kept quiet, like Captain Newport's pirating Spanish and Portuguese ships.
I mean, when Elizabeth gets involved with voyages to the new, in quotes, new world, that's her sort of personal kitty. It doesn't actually have what would be official royal backing, probably mostly because the blokes who are doing it are also doing a lot of piracy. I'm sorry, privateering. So it can't actually have royal backing.
So even back then, as the British increased their empire, marketing was key.
It's always been propagandized. People have put money, not just into the voyages, but into the reports of the voyages, into displaying the objects and people of the voyages. Selling exploration and colonization as something that is good not only for the Commonwealth, but also good for individuals to, in effect, speculate and gamble on.
We don't know if the mantle was a gift to the king or stolen and presented as such.
I think we can have various questions about how it's handed to the person who gives it to James. Is it a gift? Is it a gift in inverted commas, you know, with one hand being twisted behind a person's back? Or is it an outright theft? I don't know the answer to that.
Now, you have to know that during this period, settlers were labeling our people as savages who needed civilizing. At the same time, it's clear they viewed the mantle as a prize.
Why might somebody have suggested, coerced, or stolen this mantle to give to King James? Because it makes it appear, or it could be made to make it appear, that this leader, this king of Virginia, however they want to spin it, this other king so respects the king in England that he is giving him his mantle. How would James view a mantle like this? Well, his connection to mantles like that are, for example, coronation robes. Now, why would somebody want to tell James that this other king has given him this?
And again, it goes back to the money from the crown. Colonists had to get the king's approval to keep their project going.
And if they are telling the king, well, we're going to see no resistance because their king basically has suborned himself to you already. He sent you his ceremonial cape. So chuck money at it. There's not going to be a war. They've rolled over and showed us their bellies.
We don't have evidence when the mantle arrived in England and if it was a gift. It could have been stolen at any time before it shows up in 1638. Gabrielle Tyack suggests another theory, that Pocahontas may have brought the mantle as a gift to the king when she traveled to England in 1616. Regardless of who delivered it, let's assume the mantle went to King James I as a gift and then to his son, King Charles. It may have then gone to storage for 30 years.
It may well at some point have gone into a royal wardrobe, one of many. And this is not your back bedroom IKEA jobby. This is essentially like a big storage facility. Some of these wardrobes would be the equivalent of a city block in size.
Kings get gifts all the time. Sometimes they are taken out for display or for a party. We don't know if this was the case for the mantle. So now we return to John Tredescant and a lot of what-ifs. Along with his job as a royal gardener, Tredescant was a renowned botanist and collector with specimens from all over the world. His was considered the most comprehensive in England at the time. There's even a plant he was given from Virginia. It's called Tredescant's spiderwort. We don't know when, but at some point the mantle was given to him for his collection of rarities. It could have been by one of his employers, the Duke of Buckingham, who was a favorite of King James I. Or it may have been given to him in 1630 by King Charles, when he was appointed keeper of the gardens, vines, and silkworms at Oatlands Palace.
This is around the time where he's setting up the thing that gets known as Tradescant's Ark. This is his home. It's a garden full of interesting plants that he has collected. It's also inside going to grow into a collection. Some people refer to it as being the first museum because people can pay to enter.
It's referred to as Cabinets of Curiosity.
With Cabinets of Curiosity, it's more of a kind of collage than a display. We don't know what Tradescant's Ark look like, but we do know what other Cabinets of Curiosity look like. And there's one Italian example where there is stuff all over the ceiling, shelves stuck to the ceiling, stuffed alligator on the ceiling. There's cupboards or cabinets, unsurprisingly, all around the walls with like bits of stuffed bird sticking out of them. It's everywhere. It is quantity potentially over quality. They want weird stuff. They potentially want stuff that is not scientifically possible. There are some which claim to have mermaid hands or mermaid bodies, which are probably, they're either something that they found or it's something that a charlatan has made. Like they've sewn bits of fish together with something else and they've gone, there you go, that looks like a mermaid, crack on. So this is what we're talking about. It is probably quite chaotic, but they seem to really love it.
And we don't hear about Palatine's mantle being in this collection until a German student visits in 1638 and describes it as the robe of the King of Virginia. Not long after, Tradescant died, leaving everything to his son, who was also an avid collector and botanist.
The younger Tradescant, of course, inherits his father's house. He inherits the business. And he is very keen on the what he calls the rarities and curiosities collected. And he says that he continues in this diligence to collect and augment the Ark.
12 years later, the younger John Tradescant met Elias Ashmole, the same Ashmole for which the museum in Oxford is named, and where the mantle is on exhibit today. Ashmole helped John catalog his collection, which included Virginian purses embroidered with roanoke, a match coat of Virginia made of raccoon skins, a Virginian habit made of bearskins, a match coat from Virginia of feathers, bows from Virginia, and Powhatan, King of Virginia's habit, all embroidered with shells or roanoke. But Ashmole was no friend to Tradescant. He wanted to possess the Ark, and through some dirty dealing and a convenient death, he got it. But that's another story. The Tradescants wanted the collection to go to Oxford, and it did finally get there, but to a museum named for Ashmole, not Tradescant. And it's only recently the museum is reaching out to indigenous people to interpret their artifacts held there. Along with Powhatan's mantle, some of the Virginia artifacts in the catalog are also there.
I hope it moves us towards a kind of globalization and democratization of knowledge. That if we understand ourselves as a global curator of our shared but different histories, that it's not about possession. It's actually about recognition of heritage and weaving the tapestry of our shared but diverse histories that goes back millennia. These pieces that go back before written word.
And there's a hawk there too. Yeah. We've got an eagle and a hawk.
Back at Werowocomoco, Kaylin, Ashley, and Sam are nearly done with their time here. There's much to learn about this place and about Powhatan's mantle. Even so, both remain of great historical and spiritual importance to the tribes whose ancestors were part of Powhatan's empire. And the mantle? It's been back here in America only twice. Once in 1919 for the New York World's Fair, and again in 1990 in Virginia. It remains far away, the more than 3,600 miles across the Atlantic Ocean makes it hard to relay its beauty and uniqueness to our children. But lands once occupied by our ancestors, they matter the most. Some tribes are buying back lands, some are being returned, and some are being shared with co-stewardship. But Werowocomoco is the land that can bring tribes in Virginia together.
It was honestly a paradise, especially this spot, because you had the two creeks. Yeah, and you think about it, you have marshes, so that has lots of food, lots of medicine. There's lots of birds, ducks, geese, things of that sort that will sustain you, as well as all the different animals, abundance of fish and shellfish. So on top of a very sacred religious area, spiritual area for us, I mean, yeah, you had everything you need right here.
There's many layers of history here, and what we're trying to do is really focus in and are reconnecting, I feel like, again, this is my perspective, like working to reconnect to the ancestral history of this place. We need that first. We need that to be healed first before we can move on. Oh, now we have a great blue heron.
Yeah.
flying across us overhead. All good signs.
Yeah.
Even though it's a challenging conversation. So.
As the three stand at the site of the chief's house just outside the woods, leaves suddenly fall like snow on them. It isn't windy. Kaylin puts his hands out and smiles. And just as suddenly it stops. It feels important.
I think we're meant to be here today to have this conversation and to share this history and our perspectives on it. I truly believe that these are signs that we're heading in the right direction. There are some challenges that our tribes, I think, are facing with a federal agency owning this land, but I am a big believer in that most things happen for a reason, and we get signs along the way to kind of make us know that our ancestors are with us and they're helping guide us along that way. And I think seeing the eagle and seeing the hawk and knowing my own personal experiences and the ones that you shared, that we're heading in the right direction. It's challenging now, but it's going to change.
I'm going to England, gonna see a friend of mine. I'm going to England, see an old friend of mine. He's been gone too long, now it's his time.
Mantle Blues was written especially for this episode and performed by Chief Kevin Brown of the Pamunkey Indian Tribe. Special thanks to the Ashmolean Museum, the Jamestown Settlement Museum, and to Professor Emeriti Gary Rosenberg and Lyle Campbell. Tribal Truth is reported, written, and sound designed by Pamela D'Angelo. Kelly Libby is editor. Additional editing by David Seidel, Rebecca Hill, Sam McGowan, and Ashley Spivey. Support is provided by Virginia Humanities and the Virginia Museum of History and Culture's Commonwealth History Fund, presented by Dominion Energy. Additional support is by Radio IQ. Additional music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions. If you want to learn more about Powhatan's Mantle, Werowocomoco, and the Powhatan Alliance of Tribes, you can find links to these and to Katrina Marchant's YouTube channel episode on John Tredescant at radioiq.org.
Friend of mine. He been gone too long. Now it's about time.